Well, it's time for us to begin this morning. If you open your Bibles up to the book of Acts, we'll continue in our look at the twofold account that Luke prepares for Theophilus concerning everything that Jesus did and then everything that was accomplished afterwards. Before we get into our study this morning, though, if you would bow with me in prayer, we'll use that as our first step in spiritual growth this morning. Heavenly Father, we thank you for today and the blessings that are found in Christ. We thank you for your Son, the Spirit, and you. Please help us to be good Bible students. Help our hearts to grow. Give us wisdom. And this is our prayer in your Son's name. Amen. All right. So with the book of Acts, we have a transition that takes place that is inside the text that's a little bit based on the purpose of its writing. And so as we look at that here, let's take a few moments and kind of survey ourselves and ask some questions. We're going to be looking at a number of different things as we go through, thinking about the book of Acts and what's in here. And when you think about this particular book within our Bible, what are some of the things that immediately come to mind? What's your... You're on the whiteboard and someone says, let's talk about the book of Acts. What are the things that come to your thoughts first?
Establishing the church.
Pentecost comes in as a first part of it. What else?
History. The way the Christians act. They went from house to house sharing what they had with one another. The way they treated each other.
Yeah. Behavior of the disciples. We see a lot of that.
Where all the examples of how to become a Christian.
Yeah, inside this is a kind of a pictorial representation of transformation. If you wanted to like subtitle it, you could put Romans 12, 1 through 2, and you can put a little arrow there, or Romans chapter 10, you can put a little arrow there. Romans 8 is in here. Paul explains or expands what's going on in his letters in regards to some of the things we see here. Not only conversion, and note that the six or seven primary conversion accounts are windowed. And what I mean by that is picture your yard right now, and you're inside your house, and so you're looking at your front yard. All right, now change rooms. Go from a different room and look out that same window. Did the yard change? Is it the same yard? But does the yard look different when you look out a different window? Well, it does. And a windowed look in transformation or in conversion is what the book of Acts gives to us. And so we have to make sure that once we have those windows, we open up all of them and look at the entire yard. And we see not only a consistency of immersion or baptism, but we see other consistencies in the text as well. And so we'll see that play out. So we've got history. We've got disciple behavior. We've got conversion. We've got a few other things going on that we've mentioned. What else? What else comes to mind as important to you? Not just what you see, but what do you think is important in here?
Work of the apostles.
Right. One of the subtitles to the text is the Acts of the Apostles. And so it's focusing in on the apostles as a group. But really, who would you describe as being the primary focus in that apostle space? If you were going to say, who does the book of Acts seem to follow?
Paul
gets probably the largest space from around chapter 8 and forward. Although, he's not alone, right? Peter's got a big part. The other apostles have a big part. The other disciples as a group have a big part. Another way to think about this is to subtitle it as the Acts of God. This is God enabling, encouraging, drawing, pushing, or pulling his people to the right places at the right times. Sometimes he calls them. Says, you need to come to Macedonia. Sometimes he shows them. Let's see a vision. Let me explain to you that the gospel is for more than Israel, and do it in a very striking and challenging way. And so we're going to see a lot of those things show up. Also, with any book, particularly a theological book, that is something dealing with the nature of God, it's got to have a purpose to it to some degree. There's a reason why it's here. One of the reasons is inherent right in the very beginning of the book. In that, it says, this is part two. But why is part one and part two given to our lover of God, our Theophilus? Why would someone want to know about what everything that Jesus had did and all of the behavior and actions, the history of his disciples? What would draw someone to want to know that?
So they could
use it as a teaching text. Well, on the personal level, what if you had no intention necessarily to teach? Personal growth, emulate yourself. Wasn't ready for that. Let's back up. Yourself, personal growth, conviction. Hey, I'm not so certain about what happened. Can you reinforce or stabilize my understanding? I'm missing some details. Do you have that extra knowledge? We tend to think about the biblical text in a first-person context in that it was written for me. Not necessarily specifically, but generically, so that I could have my faith created from it. We are the beneficiaries of someone else's needs in this regard. That God worked this account to be the account that we have. Because recognize this, everybody else was talking about this at the same time. The other letters of the New Testament or the Christian Bible also talk about some of these same events in different ways. They refer back to them. And so I think a lot of that is important for us to consider as well. Let's also think about Luke chapter 1 and verse 1, where there is a prophetic edge to book 1 and book 2. There in Luke 1:1, it says, the things that have been fulfilled among us. So this is a confirmation testimony that this is God's working for them. The us aspect of it gives us understanding more about Theophilus and how he sees God and how Luke sees him. This is a communal thing. They're believers. They're lovers of God in this regard. So now the book of Acts, the Acts of the Apostles, this historical book, the story of conversions, the story of the spread of the gospel, further confirms that Jesus is the Messiah. So there's more of that too, especially when you pay attention to what gets preached. Think about the content now for a moment of what we would call sermons in the book of Acts. Number one, how long are they? That's the right answer, right? We get some that cross a particular time barrier, right? Paul prolonged his message till when? Do we know when he started? No. What do we generally assume about Paul, though? Was he short-winded or long-winded? What's our mental preconception?
Long-winded.
We just assume he's long-winded. Dude could have started in 1159. Is that a reasonable conclusion? Not so much. Just as much as this, it is for us to consider him long-winded. We simply don't know. We do know that some of the other New Testament writers refer to his insights as sometimes hard to understand, but the qualifier on that difficulty isn't because Paul was necessarily complicated. There were other factors. The weakness of the audience's faith, what Paul was dealing with, etc. And so those are factors. That's a sermon length side. Some long, some short, less.
We do know that he was going on long enough for someone to fall asleep.
That's accurate.
Pretty good indicator.
Yeah. Although, from experience, you can have a boring sermon in about 2 minutes, and so you could probably spark that in somebody. You want to know what a good sermon looks like? Look for a baby and find out how fast it goes to sleep. That's a skill of a preacher. They can put the kids to sleep, boom, you're done. So here's some things to think about now with that. We've got sermons of varied length. What about the content in the New Testament, specifically now in the book of Acts? The sermons that we can read, what do those sermons contain? What's in them in general terms? Yeah, they're evidentiary. They're using the evidence available to the audience to prove or sustain that Jesus is more than a man. To the Jew, the appeal almost generally is from the Scriptures. This is the descendant of David. To the Gentiles, the subject shifts and they appeal to nature. They appeal to humanity. They appeal to logic and reason. Even though eventually they still go back to the Scriptures. They'll eventually all drive back to this is an extension of the God of Israel, one way or another. So with all of that then, we get to have a picture that says, well, here's some ideas about what sermons are like in the New Testament for these audiences. Note that we don't get a lot of sermons, exhortations, or messages to current Christians. Look at the book of Acts. Is there a lot of detailed explanation of what gets preached in the assembly of believers? You're thinking, is there anything where they explain what gets preached?
It's in a letter in chapter 15.
There's a letter in chapter 15, and there's what we might call a congregational meeting attached to that, right? And they're dealing in those settings with something a little bit more complicated than we would like to talk about. Working through the issues communally of whether or not the gospel is just for Israel or for all, and what that means. Questions are asked. We might more informally refer to that as a Bible class, but it's got a number of different ways we can describe it. But in the end, that kind of gives us the extent of the preaching side. What else do we find in the book of Acts, content-wise? We've got history, we've got gospels, we've got preaching. What kind of things make up that history?
I think it's interesting. By the time we get to chapter 28, at the end of the book, I think it's the Jews that are saying, what they've heard about this sect is that it's spoken of against everywhere. But it's not like that. Until then, everybody holds them in high esteem, and it's growing by leaps and bounds.
Right, when it's a small counterculture revolution inside Jerusalem, the reputation is healthy in some ways. As it spreads, something begins to oppose them. There is opposition mounting as we would consider successful conversions are taking place, both first in Israel, then after the destruction of Jerusalem. We're going to see this blossoming impact of the gospel then go everywhere. And the book of Acts sets the stage for it. It's the preamble to some of those last events. And some things change. The way in which Christians who are, now this is a point to recognize, in the non-Jewish world, when they saw somebody who was a Christian, they assumed that a Christian was no different than a Pharisee, a Sadducee, or an Essene. They viewed Christians as a subset of Judaism. These are just Jews who are a little different than the former Jews. What surprised them historically was that these Jews who are Christians are converting Gentiles. And that was fundamentally new. It was not a regular practice for Israel to proselytize. Even though the New Testament records a proselyte, it's incredibly rare historically for Israel to go out and try to convert people. And so that's what underlying part of what Gary talks about, shifts Israel's setting, the Jewish context, and when Christianity breaks out of just Israel, then these conflicts start to rise more and more. Going forward, next Sunday, Michael will be looking at Acts chapter 1, verses 1 through 11 for that Bible class. And then the following Sunday will be in Acts chapter 1, the rest of it, verses 12 to 26. But I wanted to show this morning. This is a great framework to give you an approximate listing of historical details that will be useful reading through Acts. The Gospels chronicle about 3.5 to 4 years of active endeavors. There's obviously the narratives or stories of the birth of Christ and the adolescence of Christ, but really the bulk of the Gospels, particularly Luke as an example, is his later adulthood until the crucifixion. The book of Acts spans a longer period, and so anchoring when these things happen are important because it gives us some idea of what's happening for the rest of Israel and maybe in a larger sense as we see Paul's work go around the greater Mediterranean region. One of the big phrases that will take place in the text is this idea of going to the ends of the earth. It takes place there in Acts chapter 1. And what does that mean? What do we mean when we say that? Because the book of Acts, does the book of Acts ever talk about the gospel being in South America? No. Does China ever get a mention explicitly or specifically as far as we can reckon? Or Japan? Or North America? Or Alaska? I'm using our modern, geographical terms to describe those places. So when we start thinking about the impact of the gospel in the first century, we have to realize that we have to, again, take a few moments at different times to say, okay, what are we talking about with these terms? What do we mean by them? What do they mean by them? How do they see it? And I'll repeat an illustration that's really important. We did this, I think, last week, maybe a couple weeks before that. Think about Genesis 1. The text of Genesis 1 and the story of creation to the Jew who has no knowledge of the Messiah, when they read Genesis 1 and they read the testimony of Moses that says the Spirit of God moved across the waters, they don't immediately think the Spirit because that's not been fully revealed to them yet. And when they say the creation was accomplished by someone, they exclusively say God, and we would say God the Father. But the Messiah isn't part of their picture because they don't have a clear vision of whom the Messiah is. How do we know that? Well, how did they act when he walked on the earth? No clear knowledge. So we read Jesus and the Spirit and the Father into the creation, lawfully and legitimately, because we have extra knowledge that they didn't have. And even the Bible refers to it, that these things were not revealed to them. These were mysteries they yearned to know. That's the same thing when we're reading through the book of Acts. We're reading it with the upper view, like we've got this aerial shot, because we can see where they are, we can see where they're going, and we're looking at it with a little bit of the eye of, I know what the story plays out to. If you're reading a mystery novel, you already know that the butler did it. Those butlers always are the trouble. It's probably a good idea never to have a butler. I think based on every murder mystery ever, butlers, not good. Even if you're Batman, I think it's probably not a great idea. His butler seems to be extra special, though. So, thinking about what we have here, we've got the, inside the book of Acts, we've got the day of Pentecost, referred to us in Acts 2. I've got the date AD 33 here for our visualization of it. Realize that that's approximate. because the calendar calculations that have us dating these events are approximately off by a couple of years. We say plus or minus 4 years because of some calculation errors, but they're in sequence according to ordering. And so that's fine. Either of the possibilities, 29, 33, 36, not so much relevant as to what happens on that approximate date. There's a shift in the empire around AD 41. Claudius is now reigning. Then we have Herod Agrippa in that same time frame, king of Judea. That's important historically because in this region, in this area, this Herod becomes, rises to prominence, powerful man, builder, knowledge about the empire. Claudius will then eventually expel the Jews from Rome in AD 51. Gallio becomes the proconsul of Achaia. Felix, the governor of Palestine. Festus then becomes governor of Palestine later. And Nero Claudius Caesar is now emperor of Rome towards the end of that. That's important because it might help us date internally events within the scriptures. Some of these individuals also make their note in archaeology from this time frame. Their name is put on everything. If you go downtown in almost any community, whomever was seated as the leaders in that community when a thing was built, there's plaques. Mayor such and such signed into law that we would do project so and so, and here's a park. And so you see it all the time today. Well, it's kind of always been that way. If you go look at the archaeological remains of the communities and cities of the time of Jesus, the leaders' names continue to pop up in different places. In the time of the first century, there's a lot of stuff involving Herod, and so that's an important historical marker because they cite him often in the book of Acts, and so it ties the time together for us. Any questions about this little bit of information here? Things that are important to you? We're going to go back to the text here and introducing the overall book here in a moment. Michael?
It's probably not really important. It's just interesting to me when I look at that timeline. I think about Cornelius and how such a major event was. I think that 8 to 12, 13 years passed. Just never really realized that.
Yeah, and that's something about the book of Acts. Again, it covers a longer period than the Gospels do. Far less detail. We don't get as much interpersonal conversation of Jesus teaching a disciple like we find in the Gospels in the book of Acts. We simply don't get it. We get a little bit of dialogue. You get court speeches. You get Pauline statements of Paul and his disagreement with Barnabas. You get a hint of that. You get some other aspects of events that take place at some of the conversions. We simply don't get that level of detail, but it stretches it out now over this long chunk of time. And a lot happens. Think about it this way. If we're thinking about this full perspective about 35 years, how much has your life shifted in 35 years? Yeah, what was your home like 35 years ago? Where were you living? Did you know each other 35 years ago? Some of you go, yeah, I knew. Jesse's like, wait a minute. He's the youngster, so... In all of those things, you now have a picture of how much things can change for us. Understand that that's a people thing, not a time or an era thing. You say, well, yeah, but things are so much faster for us now. Not in these same ways. Because tremendous change happens surrounding the life of Saul/Paul. Remember, his childhood space where he was born gave him the right of Roman citizenship. He was not born in Jerusalem. He moved there. He had some level of family in Rome that was present there that he was speaking positively of. And so he, maybe unlike us, had actually lived in multiple countries. And that shift created a little bit about the story of Paul's journeys that we see now. He's cosmopolitan. He's been around. He's done things. He's educated as well. Les?
I think we don't, I know I did for a long time, really think about the time in years that from the time Paul was converted, we kind of have the impression he just jumped right in to everything, but it was 14 years after his conversion before he came back to the apostles and met them.
Right. Part of that is dealt with in his writings. He's like, I didn't do that. We also have this picture of Paul never staying in one place for very long. That's actually not accurate. He does move around, but he also establishes himself at different points for long periods of time, preaching the gospel. He does so, as a side note, and the text deals with this a little bit, in two ways. He has an occupation, and what do we say? We use this term now to refer to general things, but what was his occupation as far as we can tell?
Tent maker.
Yeah, tent maker, right? So now we use that as a metaphor. Just making tents. This is my tent making job. You know, I got other things more important, but I'm just doing this to pay the bills. That phrase now has left the Bible and moved into common conversation, not just amongst believers. It actually is just a phrase that gets used this way. Understand that being a tent maker makes him a tradesman, skilled tradesman. And this is a process that is more substantial than just it being able to stitch a seam. There's a lot that goes into the dyeing, construction, and preparation of a successful tent in the first century. It's not a camping tent. This is a dwelling for individuals who would be semi-nomadic. It has to be strong to handle the wadis, the big rains that would come down and flush through those stream areas. And so there's a lot more going on there. And he does that for profit in cities that were very, again, cosmopolitan. People are going to be buying from everywhere. He also, though, in the same time frame, refuses to do that because there are times when he receives support to preach. So he's an interesting example that's given for us as an apostle who argues in favor of the right for spiritual labor to be supported, sometimes doesn't. And we see some of his rationale play out. Explanation might happen in the epistles, but the reasoning he uses occurs in the letters here, but the effects of it are sometimes seen in these gospel events in the book of Acts. Let's talk a little bit more about the purpose of the book, kind of get honed in on some of the key ideas or principles. We've already identified that one of the purposes for the book seems to be confirmation, that it's going to confirm things about Jesus. And it shows up in the messages. But I'll also add, you'll note this in verse 8. I mentioned this earlier, verse 8 of chapter 1. It reads there, but you will receive power when the Holy Spirit has come upon you, and you'll be my witness in Jerusalem and in all Judea and Samaria and to the end of the earth. The book of Acts essentially starts that process roughly in that sequence, by the way. It roughly goes from Judea to the greater Samaritan region and then to the end of the earth. It's interesting, if you were to ask Luke or pretty much anyone living in the first century what they meant by the end of the earth, they probably mean something different than what you and I mean. What seems to be our answer to this question, reading back into it now from where we're at? When Luke writes to the end of the earth, who do we include?
Everyone.
We include everyone. When he writes it, He also means everyone. But his definition of where the end of the earth was kind of ended at the Atlantic to a degree. Because when you look at the way this phrase gets used, it's a phrase that's actually used to say as far as we know, to go everywhere we know it's going to go. There are limited cases where they're really just talking about that regional area, but they're using it in a very as far as it can go type sense wherever else we find it. And so that's a phrase that kind of just is ambiguous or not defined. And look inside the book. How much shifts? In the latter part of the book of Acts, Jerusalem is no longer a big deal. Lots of reasons why that's the case, but foremost, the story that God is writing through the lives of his disciples has shifted out of Jerusalem. It's no longer the necessary center point that it once was. Further, when the book of Acts closes, does it end like with a neat little bow that says that everything was great and they all went home happily ever after? Has it got that classic ending? How much is unsettled when this account is closed off and mailed to Theophilus?
It's a continuing thing when they say it's going to all the world, preach the gospel to every creature.
Right.
It's the beginning point, really.
It actually isn't an end at all. Do we know what happens to Paul inside the text? Do we know about his death? Think about it this way. Think about all of the named apostles of the New Testament. Do we know about any of their outcomes from the New Testament text? You see, we tend to make this conclusion based on how we read perhaps Revelation and what history also tells us, that what was foretold about their deaths came to pass. Then we're reading back into history based on our understanding of what was said, that the end of the apostles was most likely what? Do they have quiet, peaceful, die-at-home moments?
Probably only John.
Yeah, and even John's a bit of a mystery, but we think maybe John. History suggests that, for the most part, all of their, we want to die with you, we want to die like you, Jesus warning them of what that meant, actually kind of comes to pass. They all end up in captivity to some degree or another. They're all abused because of their faith. They all die at a period, a time frame, when the kingdom that had once been ballooning is plateauing and is now receiving significant pressure back. So there's a lot of mystery there that's not truly answered for us in the level of detail that we want. In the book of Acts, when it closes off, we're not quite sure what's even going to happen to Paul. He has a desire, right? He wants to come back. He wants to go do these next things. He's gained access to preach in his captivity, but it shifts, like many things do. Because the last quarter of the book of Acts deals with Paul's arrest, his defense, his arrival in Rome, and Luke is writing specifically to believers who need to know this. Think for a moment real quickly, how does Paul describe his captivity in his letters? When he is a prisoner being pushed along by the winds of God to Rome, what are some of the statements he makes about that? He's doing his work. The work still has to be done. Does he feel alone? Sometimes he talks about how everyone's left him. Only a few have come for them. He makes practical requests. Hey, I really need... What are the two things that he wants? His cloak and his notes, his books. I need those. He talks about how in captivity, he befriended a runaway slave and sends him back. And so there's a lot of that aspect that is important for Christians to know. Because remember, they're not going to the news to find out reports on captured Christians held in captivity in other nations. Their only network of information is a letter or something like this that's being shared as saying, this is what Paul's going through. This is the context of his experiences. Further, I'll kind of put as a last closing comment on this part of it. The book of Acts is in some ways the fulfillment of all of the New Testament's pledges, or the Old Testament's pledges for a new kingdom. We see it unfold maybe in the writings of the Hebrew writer in chapter 8 and chapter 10, where there's a contrast between the Old Kingdom and the New Kingdom, the Old Covenant and the New Covenant. We see it pledged by Jesus that his kingdom is coming, but it is in the book of Acts wherein you see all that occupied. The promise had been made. Folks would be eventually translated into the kingdom of God, but yet in the end, it's really only in the book of Acts that we see those occupancy letters taking place. Hey, we're here. Hey, we've been added to the kingdom. Even our terminology comes from this text. Something also important there to think about is that this new kingdom space is a challenge for everybody. Even though Jesus had told them regularly about what this was going to look like and what it would be like, and it would be difficult, and they would be challenged because of whom their king was. All of this is foreknown.
Gary? And thinking about the kingdom, in verse 3, that's what Jesus was talking about for 40 days before he went up into heaven.
Yeah. You know, there is undetailed interaction between Jesus and the apostles that's just said, and he talked to them about stuff. Is a shortened form of it. Also in the book of Acts is when you see the shift from how these disciples think about Israel. Prior to Acts, Israel was codified as being genetically connected. You are a descendant of the right tribe. That means you're in Israel. Paul would help in the letter to the Galatians, explain how a Gentile can be part of Israel. And he would explain it in concrete and specific terminology, say you've been grafted in because others have been cut out. And so in the book of Acts, you see that happen. Think about how traumatic it was for Peter. Remember, Peter is part of the group prior to Christ that seems incredibly zealous to fight for the arrival of a Messiah. He's not specifically identified as a zealot, but he behaves like one. Ready to fight, ready to pull out my sword. And God chooses him as part of the revelatory process to say, hey, those Gentiles whom you are willing to fight off, they're part of the kingdom now too. And that comes forth in the book of Acts. And you see this commitment level within him have its impact. All right. Standard questions. Non-standard answers. When you think about the book of Acts, we've talked about like what you think about it first. What's something in the book that you like? A lot of examples.
I like the way it's written. It's not like an epistle. It's like storytelling. And we learn things, you know, by seeing.
Yeah, it's got that. It's written in a narrative rather than an instructive list of this, which gives our examples. We can step into those shoes of the people that are there. What else? What else do you like in the book of Acts? I'll just tell you, I like that it's exciting. There are aspects of the book of Acts that are written with that story form that show the drama of God's people's lives unfolding. Just like in the historical books of the Old Testament, you see a lot of those same things happen. You see the replication of the moral behavior of disciples as it interacts with the world around them. Their willingness to stay committed to their cause, no matter what the consequences. You think about this. Think about the prison scene where the disciples are broken free by God and they pause and consider the people around them. And they consider the jailer. And they move in a way that's God fearful, but also kingdom forward. And when all that plays out, Luke has given us such a great account of it. Feels like you're there. It feels like you're in the room watching it happen. And I think there's some value to that for us as well. Anything in here that teaches us about ourselves or about Jesus and God? Think about the stoning of Stephen. Where do we see Jesus, the stoning of Stephen?
Standing.
He's standing. And how is he normally portrayed?
Seated.
Normally he's seated. There's a shift in his posture. And so we get to learn about the communication shift there. Hey, why is he standing? Why is this story different? What's going on? Well, we know what's going on with Stephen. So there's something in that storytelling shift that's important. So we learn that God's interest shifts on the basis of his people, his disciples. And so there's that there. General terms, what's this teaching us about God? Or me?
That God knows the hearts of men.
Yeah, you got the impact of the gospel as it pierces through the whatever is causing someone not to recognize their own spiritual condition. They get pierced to the heart because the message sticks or impacts them or changes their way of thinking. You get the stories of Saul and how blind he was. And Luke gives us an account that shows his blindness is a metaphor in some ways for his transformation, because he talks about whom he was and who he became in those way in those contexts, and now he can see. Even though later in the New Testament, we see that vision is an issue to some degree on a physical level as well. Any last comments before we close out for this morning? All right then, so for next Sunday, you'll want to have really read the first chapter of the book of Acts. Come prepared to participate as Michael teaches, and looking forward to continuing our study of the book of Acts. Thanks, everybody.